source for progressive political viewpoints.
Now get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the topic is ideology and economics. Yesterday, or this week, U.S. Commerce Department Census Bureau released a report showing how incomes are growing. At the median level, household incomes. In other words, we are becoming less unequal. Income inequality trends are finally beginning to reverse. Well, is it true? We're going to see it's not true. This argument, based on U.S. Government Department of Commerce Census Bureau data, is an example of what we call ideology in economics. Mainstream economics is full of ideology, as opposed to science, science based on facts and deductions based on facts and observations of facts. Ideology is not based on observations. It's based on arguments that obfuscate and confuse and distort the facts. And economics, as all social sciences, are full of this. We're going to define what we mean shortly by ideology. But first, some examples in economics, mainstream economics, of ideology in action. We're hearing a lot these days about the big corporate tax cuts coming and how if we cut corporate taxes, it will create jobs. So the first argument of ideology is that business tax cuts will create jobs. And, you know, the corporate parties of America have gotten pretty good at labeling every tax cut legislation a job creation legislation. Especially since 2000 under Bush, every big corporate and investor and wealthy tax cut has been called a job-creating bill. But this claim is false. Business tax cuts do not necessarily create jobs. In fact, have been creating fewer and fewer jobs. So that proposition, that claim that business tax cuts create jobs is ideological. It's not factual. It's not observable reality. We'll talk about that as an example, as now the talk of business tax cuts coming intensify. Okay, so the first ideological claim in economics is business tax cuts create jobs. Another one we hear a lot about is free trade and competitive advantage raise all boats, meaning everybody benefits from trade and free trade. Both sides, both countries and both businesses in both countries and both sets of workers in both countries always benefit by free trade. Of course, that's been in the news here for years now. Before 2008, we heard a lot about how markets are efficient. Remember that one? A lot of people have been writing about that, debunking that. Markets are efficient. In other words, don't interfere in markets, government. Just let those who control the markets and whoever has the most money controls the markets, just let them run loose. Well, we saw what happened with financial markets, didn't we, in 2008-09. We let people run loose, let bankers and shadow bankers and investors have their way, deregulated everything, and we see what they caused, right? And, of course, that wasn't the first time historically we've gone through this thing several times in the last century, where you let the bankers deregulate and, quote, financial markets are efficient, and then you get a big crash. Okay, so that's another argument, ideological argument. Markets are always efficient, right? Tax cuts create jobs. Free trade competitive advantage, which is an academic fanciful argument to support free trade, lifts all boats. Okay, so these are the big three ideological claims in economics. But there's more, less known, but in operation nonetheless, of been notions like central banks are independent of the private banking system or of government, right? And they should be. They should be independent. This is the argument. We got to make sure that the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England are independent, technicians making decisions without political influence by the bankers, private bankers, or the government, which are often representatives of private bankers. You don't believe me? Who's in control of the U.S. Treasury? Mnuchin. Steve Mnuchin, right? Goldman Sachs. Who's in control of the New York Federal Reserve? Oh, well, another guy from Goldman Sachs, Bill Dudley. Who's going to replace Janet Yellen when she leaves? Well, it's probably going to be Gary Cohn, another Goldman Sachser. And they got their staffs, of course, which they pull from the private banks as well. And there's lots of other ways that the private bankers are pretty much make the major decisions or influence the major decisions in these central banks. That's what I addressed in great detail in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, Monetary Policy and Coming Depression, just published here last month by Clarity Press. You can take a look at that in some reviews. The first review has just come out. It's on my blog, jackerasmus.com, by David Baker. Others are forthcoming. And I'll be posting some information and selections as I've been posting articles on that on my blog, jackerasmus.com, and also on my website, kiklosproductions.com. Anyway, that's the plug for the book, but it's relevant. What are some of the other ideological notions here in mainstream economics besides those already mentioned? Well, interest rates determine investment. If we only lower interest rates, it will generate a real investment, reduce the cost of borrowing money, and businesses will therefore invest in creating goods and services, producing more. And that will hire more people and create more wages, more income, blah, 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 right? Well, historically, the facts contradict that as well. You know, we've had 9 years of virtual zero interest rates, and we've had declining real investment throughout the whole period. So the facts don't support that interest rates determine investment. What's another one? Inflation is always too much money chasing too few goods. In other words, we get inflation because we have so much increase in this money supply that's generated by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, or incentivized by the central bank, right? And that causes all this inflation in goods and services. Well, we've had the most massive increase in money supply in U.S. history since 2008, and inflation still running in goods and services at least around 1.1-1.2%. Wow, so much for that argument. And there are economists who have built their reputations on this monetarist view that inflation is going to happen because of all the massive increase in money supply and credit. Well, just the opposite has happened, and they don't explain that. They have no explanation. You see, because this is an argument not based upon observation of facts, which would be scientific. It's an argument that is ideological. It's created as a intellectual academic justification for policymakers to reduce interest rates. That's the difference between ideology and science. You see, economics is partly science, as all social sciences are, partly science and partly ideology. And they get mixed up pretty good. An average person has a hard time sometimes determining which is which is true, which is false, because ideology is false. You see, when we say ideology here, we're not talking about isms like, you know, capitalism or socialism or fascism or communism. You know, no isms. That's not what ideology is here. It's not a worldview that someone may have, right? Ideology is the process of how ideas get falsified. How you falsify an original idea, transform it, change it, divert it, pervert it from its original meaning. Language games, and as the philosopher Wittgenstein explained them, right? Or as Karl Marx explained ideology, or began to. We're talking about ideology as falsification of original ideas and the processes by which the falsification by very clever think tankers and pundits and those in the media change the meaning of things from their original sense for a certain purpose. And the purpose is to support the economic interests of certain wealthy people in their organizations, right? That's what ideology and economics is about. Okay, so what are some of the other ideological notions here? That recessions are caused by external shocks to the system. In other words, the system is inherently stable. It's, as economists say, naturally in equilibrium. It's balanced. In other words, a balanced system is kind of a system that's preferable, isn't it? You know, so when we do get these recessions, it's because things outside the system knock it off its equilibrium pedestal somehow. They're external. They're shocks. And that the system can recover if you just leave it alone. You see? That's what the argument is. That's also tied in with the argument that markets are efficient. Because markets are efficient, if you don't intervene with them, Mr. Government, they'll recover. You know, they only have recessions because of external shocks, you know, like we had in the 70s and 80s when the oil price shock occurred in the Middle East, right, threw the system off. Or we have policy shocks by government under Ronald Reagan, purposely created the deep recession in 1981-82 to make the average household and consumer and worker pay for the oil price shock that generated the excess inflation. You know, he took it out on, instead of taking it out on Saudi Arabia and the folks that caused it, took it out on American consumer, caused deep recession that brought prices down. Okay, so those are shocks, you see, or external shocks. There's nothing inherent, endemic to the system that causes instability. Well, where's the shock for 2008-09? Can't point to any external shock. It was the banking system that collapsed, as it typically does periodically under capitalism. It was an endemic, inherent, intrinsic development within the financial system that precipitated that crash and that problem. Okay. So the system is not inherently at equilibrium. It is always moving towards ever greater disequilibrium, instability. Instability is the nature of the system, not stability. Okay, so that's a notion, though, that recessions are caused by external shocks. It's an ideological notion. Another one that we heard during prior to the crisis is that, the housing bubble that was associated with the crash was really due to a, quote, glut of savings, a savings glut. You see, that's what Greenspan, the head of the Fed at the time, and Bernanke also, his protege, you know, that's what they were saying, that, it's all this savings, all this money offshore. They don't call it excess profits. They call it savings. of course, by the super wealthy. All this savings offshore flowed into the U.S. and drove up the prices of housing that ended up in a bubble that crashed, right? So it was all these foreigners who caused the problem in the crash of 2008, right? Global savings glut, as they called it. That's a way of blaming people outside the system instead of the people inside, the bankers, shadow bankers, the speculators, the policymakers that deregulated, right? That's what caused the bubble and the crash. Okay, so one more item that we want to talk about today about ideology is income is determined by one's productivity. In other words, if you're poor, it's because you aren't productive. You want to get richer? Get more productive. Go out and, get some specialty degree if you're an average worker here, become a doctor or, become a dentist or, become a data scientist or software engineer or something. You're more productive, therefore you'll get more income, which totally ignores the fact that most of these massive incomes are not because of productivity of their individuals, but because they're speculators, because they manipulate the financial markets. That's how you really get rich, and that has nothing to do with productivity. But anyway, this notion for well over a century now is that, if you're you don't have high enough income, it's because you're not productive. You want more income? Go get more productive. In other words, prove yourself to businesses and corporations that you can earn them even more money, and they'll pay you maybe a little bit more. So productivity determines one's income is another ideological notion. So, just to repeat these typical notions of ideology and economics here, and then we'll go on to define what I mean by ideology, and then some contemporary examples. For example, is a summary: business tax cuts create jobs, free trade lifts all boats, markets are efficient, central banks are independent of banks, interest rates determine investment, inflation is always too much money chasing too few goods, recessions are caused by external shocks to a stable equilibrium system. Global savings glut caused the housing bubble and crash. Well, and income inequality is determined by one's productivity. These are ideological notions because they are not based on observable facts. In fact, most of the facts contradict these arguments. So let's talk about how ideas become ideological. You see, ideas can be based on observation and science and not be ideological. They can be true, factual, or they can be ideological ideas, in other words, distortions of the facts of the true. All ideas are composed of the following: a set of factual statements, opinions about the relationships between the facts, i.e. causality relationships or other kinds of logical relationships between the facts, a set of historical examples in support of one's opinions, and predictions about where these relationships between the facts and the arguments and the logical relationships might lead. These are called propositions, these statements of facts, opinions, logical argument, historical examples, predictions. These are propositions that compose the idea. Sometimes an idea is very complex, full of many kinds of propositions, and the propositions can be simple or complex. Right. By the way, this is based on philosophy of language in many cases, Wittgenstein and people like that, right? So how ideas are formed, theory of language, you see. So the key concept here is propositions. What are the propositions that compose an idea? Now, when an idea is first formed, it is composed of a set of original propositions and facts, combination of propositions and facts, right? An idea evolves, can evolve and become ideological when those who take the original idea distort it purposely. You could make an error in evaluating the evolution of an idea. In other words, it wasn't purposeful, right? That's not ideology. That's just, an error. But when you purposely attempt to distort the original sets of propositions composing the idea, that is ideological. And, that's what the think tanks do. Out there, the American Enterprise Institute, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, I'm talking about economic ideas now, right? Talk shows, other sources of print and verbal conversation about ideas, purposely set out to distort an original idea. For example, if you go back in economics, the history of economic thought, the classical economists, Adam Smith and others, never believed that tax cuts created investment and jobs. In fact, some of them argued the contrary, that by raising taxes, you would create jobs. Because by raising taxes, you would raise costs on businesses, and businesses would look for some other way to increase productivity to reduce their costs, to offset the tax increase. So actually, tax increases stimulated investment and jobs, you see, originally. In recent decades, it's become just the opposite. Oh, that tax cuts generate jobs. All right, so what are some of the techniques by which these purposeful distortions of original propositions and ideas occur? I wrote an article several years back about ideology and economic policy, focusing on the tax cut claims of ideology. And I think I'll probably post that on my blog, jackerasmus.com, again for our readers after the show here. So if you want to read that in more detail, more of an academic article, I guess. But if you're interested in a more concise explanation, just take a look at jackerasmus.com over the next few days. Okay, but what are the techniques? In this article, I spell out the techniques by which distortion of original ideas occurs. One is called an inversion. You rearrange the various propositions that compose the idea. You invert them. Another is reversal. The original idea may have had a certain cause and effect claim between facts and or other elements within the idea. You reverse that cause and effect. Instead of A causing B, now B causes A. See, that's a distortion. Inverting the relationships between the propositions is a kind of distortion. Conversion is another technique where instead of just correlations between facts and propositions are now claimed to be causation. You see, and economics is full of assumptions, implicit, that causation occurs when it's only really correlation, right? Correlation is where two variables move in the same direction or inverse direction. So, it appears as if one may be causing the other. Which one causes which is unclear in a correlation. But then economists come along, ideologists come along in economics, and they say, oh, no, it's a causation. In other words, if you increase the money supply, therefore inflation is going to go up. That's a claim of a correlation that's really a causation, right? Another technique is insertion. You add a totally foreign, contradictory proposition into the set of propositions that constitute the original idea. You insert something totally different. And then, of course, you can claim a causative relationship instead of correlation, or you can reverse a cause and effect. You see, these techniques work in combination with each other. What's another technique? Deletion. I can just as add a totally new contradictory proposition within the idea, I can remove or de-emphasize or ignore what was previously an essential proposition in the original idea. I can do that as well. Substitution, another technique. What's substitution? I add a foreign proposition to an existing proposition. I merge them, and they become a totally new proposition within the original set of ideas. Another technique is to detemporalize. In other words, to dehistoricize and assume that a proposition or an idea is timeless. In other words, it's not historically determined. It doesn't exist forever. You know, it appeared because of a certain set of conditions at a certain period in time, and as those conditions change, it will disappear, right? But the detemporalization means that you make a claim that the proposition or the idea itself is historically forever true. Now, there is no history here, right? Dehistorize, or whatever you want to call it. Now, universalize is the final technique here, right? And that's to assume that the idea or propositions went in it, but the idea itself, which is not generally true, is only in true in a particular sense, now it's generally true, right? Or to say the partial is now the whole, or the temporary is now permanent. All of these techniques, again, read the article if you wish, are techniques by which purposeful distortion of original ideas occurs over time. And this distortion can take place multiple times. And by the time you have decades of ideological operations on original ideas, you come up with something that's quite different than it was originally intended to be. You see, ideas and language evolve. They are not constant at any one time. All ideas evolve, and now they can evolve scientifically by observation, right? You take quantum mechanics and you discover more subatomic particles and so forth, and the ideas develop over time, but it's all by observation, you see, and factual. In social sciences, particularly economics, where there's so much to be gained by certain minorities, wealthy people, from manipulating ideas, financially gained, the incentive to change ideas and evolve them to support your personal interests is pretty intense, and it's pretty easy to do. Because a lot of the ideas are not based on facts. It's not as if you're observing a physical hypothesis that you may have actually occurring, or it's not as if you're going to run blind tests like they do in testing of drugs and effects like that. You can't do that. You can't have that kind of a control over the facts in social sciences, including economics. But economics, tends to try to make itself appear as if it's scientific because it deals with data and statistics and stuff like that. And it has developed all these mathematical techniques, which oftentimes times are neutral and can be used to falsify ideas as well as clarify ideas, right? So, you know, in economics, there's a lot of vested interests and a lot of people being paid to distort ideas all the time in support of those who pay them. Hmm? Tax cuts create jobs. Well, you know, who's promoting that nonsense? Well, it's the people, you know, who are going to benefit from the tax cuts. You know, they fund the think tanks, you know, their media, Wall Street Journal editorial page and so forth, you know, are in their service. So indirectly or directly, you know, they sometimes even pay for articles by prostitute academics who are willing to, for money, say whatever needs to be said, you know, and we've seen that time and time again with the climate deniers and tobacco companies and drug companies and so forth. There are people in academic positions who will just lie for money. And there are those who just get swept up in the idea change and who believe the ideas as they change. You know, a lot of academics who, you know, aren't dishonest actually believe free trade lifts all boats. You know, they believe the ideology. It comes to be written in their textbooks, and, you know, if it's in the textbook, it must be correct, right, or it wouldn't be there. Of course, that's nonsense. And, you know, they absorb these ideas that are ideological and promote them. I mean, most economists still believe that recessions are due to external shocks, and some are. You see, that's the appeal of ideology. There's always a kernel of truth in it. And the idea is, the idea, no pun intended, is that the original idea gets distorted. Well, it wouldn't be convincing if you distort what's obviously false in the first place, right? You have to subtly distort what is obviously true in the first place, based on observation, right? Okay. Let's take this idea, tax cuts create jobs ideology. The latest iteration of this form of falsification just appeared this past week by this well-connected economist, Douglas Holtz Eakin, right, who's tied in with the Democratic and Republican parties. I think he was a seat on the Council of Economic Advisors for either Obama or for Bush or somebody there, right? Douglas Holtz Eakin. There's a bunch of these guys who are really, you know, 2 feet, 1.5 foot in tied in with the political parties and the administrations, and, you know, 1.5 foot in academia, you know, like Glenn Hubbard, you know, and Feldstein there in Harvard, and Summers, and so forth. You know, they hold an academic position in order to have credentials that help them influence policy. Right? They appear before congressional committees and make their arguments and write their articles that get publicized among the elites, etc. So anyway, this Holtz Deacon here on September 13th, who is now president of the American Action Forum, a right-wing think tank here, right, came out and stated, as a number of these guys are now doing, because the you know, this corporate tax cut bill is on the fast track here, and we'll see something in terms of a corporate tax cuts probably before or soon after the end of this year, right? And I've talked about that before, about all these massive corporate tax cuts and investor tax cuts and wealthiest 1% household tax cuts, which have been occurring, particularly since George W. Bush. You know, we're talking, you know, well over $10 trillion in tax cuts here to this group. Anyway, in his latest little editorial piece in the Wall Street Journal, Douglas Eakin, Douglas Holtz Eakin, hyphenated last name there, right, made the argument that workers bear the majority of the tax burden when corporate taxes are raised, tax hikes. In other words, when we say bear the burden of a tax, it means that the effect of the tax gets shifted from the corporation to their workers, or to workers in general. Right? And 50 to 75%, he says, studies show, of a tax hike are actually ultimately paid for by workers, either working for that company or as workers as consumers, right? In other words, the big corporations pass on, are able to pass on their tax hikes to the labor force, either directly or indirectly. And that's probably true. It varies by industry, of course, and a number of other factors. But it's true that the tax burden gets shifted. But it's not necessarily true, the opposite, you see. What Holtz-Eakin argues is that if you cut taxes, it will lead to wage increases. Raise taxes, it has a negative effect on wage, real wage, because workers have to pay the most of it. But he inverts that, and he says just the opposite, that if you cut taxes, just the opposite will happen to wages. Wages will increase. Again, this is a correlation posing as a causation argument, and it's an inversion technique here as well. Okay. It doesn't follow that a tax cut means wage increase. Okay. The argument is that, if you cut corporations' taxes, they'll have more disposable income, because they won't be paying the taxes, they'll have that extra income, and that extra income will result in giving workers more wages. Hmm? A similar argument is the tax cut will result in more real investment by the business, which will result in more employment, and therefore, if you have more employment, it means more wage increases. See, more demand for labor raises the price of labor, wages, and more wages rise. See, that's the logical economic argument, and it is it carries some influence. It seems, that seems true. I mean, if you got more money, you can spend it on investment and raising wages, right? It's a logical argument, but it's not a real argument. In other words, that's not how it happens in the real world, in real time. Hmm? What does happen when you give businesses tax cuts? What's observable that does happen over the last decade and a half? Well, they, of course, have greater retained earnings and profits, because their after-tax profits go up because they're not paying as much taxes, right? But what do they do? Well, observation, science, tells us they do one or more of the following. One, they distribute the extra income to shareholders in dividends, or they use it to buy back their stock, which drives up the price of their stock and benefits their shareholders, okay? Or they reinvest in financial markets themselves. You know, these big corporations now, they're really banks. I mean, look what's happening with, Walmart. They're becoming a bank, right? And a lot of companies now that are non-bank companies are becoming banks. This is all part of this merging between what's traditional banks and what I call shadow banks that I addressed in detail in my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, chapters 12, 13, in 2016. So they reinvest in financial markets, or they take the money and put it offshore in some tax haven somewhere. It's like the tech companies, the banks, and the pharma companies. They're all doing that, right? Trillions and trillions of dollars offshore in tax havens or in their subsidiaries, so they don't have to bring it out bring it back and pay taxes, right? Or they just retain it on their balance sheets, which become more and more bloated. I mean, like Apple Corporation, right, has $260 billion on his balance sheet of profits undistributed, 90% of which are held offshore. So this is what they really do when you cut taxes, one or more of these things. They don't necessarily give wage increases to their workers, or necessarily even use it to expand their operations and their production. And if you look at the real data, the real facts, investment has been declining, and that's why productivity is declining. And both are very clear. Even though profits and retained earnings from tax cuts and other squeezing of workers, profit margins, and so forth, have doubled and tripled in recent years. So this argument that if you simply cut taxes, it will result in wage increases, Mr. Holtz-Eakin, is false. It's nonsense. But, it's the kind of argument that corporations really like to see. Right? If you say it enough times and enough sources and repeat it, verbally, talk shows, online, so forth, people will believe it. Because it's got an element of logical trueness to it. Hmm? Well, if I got more money, I could invest more. I could give more wages. But to assume you will is not necessarily true. The original idea gets distorted, perverted by these arguments. An observable fact are sometimes contradictory observations, but, they conveniently ignore that. And you get paid-for economists who will be glad to write something to justify, the interest of wealthy corporations and investors, because that's how you get promoted in academia, and you get nice extra consulting jobs. That brings in a lot of income, and you become very influential in the business school, and your job is insured. Assured, or maybe you even get invited to sit on boards and of different businesses, like Larry Summers and Glenn Hubbard and those guys, and Martin Feldstein, all of those. Or you might get asked to sit on the Federal Reserve, like some guys have done, including Janet Yellen. A lot of them come from academia, you see, but they got to prove themselves first before they bring them on in that role. Okay, so that's the debunking here of this example of tax cuts create jobs ideological notion and argument. Another one that we're seeing popping up here, that just popped up this last week once again, is the notion of your income is a function, is determined by how productive you are. If you are poor, it's because you're not productive. You're in a job that doesn't really produce a lot. Therefore, get yourself productive. Go out and get an advanced degree in something, and you'll be more productive, more valuable, and you'll get paid more. Income inequality is a function of lack of productivity on the poor. In other words, it's a way of saying that you're the cause of the fact that you're poor. In other words, the victim is the cause of his own victimization. Divert the attention from the real cause of income inequality in this country, and it's your fault, worker, right? You're just not productive enough. You're the reason, not someone else. It's not the way the system is set up to benefit the wealthy. It's you. So go out and get yourself some productivity, some education. And there's some truth to that. All ideology has an element of significant truth to it, but it gets distorted. Okay, so David Brooks, you know, you watch him on TV on KQED on PBS, right? David Brooks, New York Times columnist, you know, sort of a liberal, well, maybe not liberal, but a centrist Republican, you know. He recently came out, in fact, today with an editorial piece, right, about trying to debunk this notion that capitalism is failing people more and more, not delivering, in other words, by saying that, quote, the market is working as it's supposed to. And he's referring to the report this past week by the Commerce Department Census Bureau on income and poverty trends, right, which said, concluded, you know, this report concluded that median household incomes in the last 2 years have risen. In fact, in 2015, risen fastest since the 1960s. And in last year's 2016, it's risen as well, but not as fast, right? So, you know, the market is working as it's supposed to. We are recovering. Incomes are recovering. You know, therefore, income inequality is not continuing to escalate and accelerate. It's modifying. Another quote from David Brooks, right? Quote, in a well-functioning economy, workers are rewarded for their productivity. In the past 2 years, that's exactly what's happening. Income has not decoupled from productivity, unquote. You know, this is a 19th century economic version of the relationship between productivity and income. Well, you know, productivity has been collapsing the past 2 years. In this year, growing less than 0.5%, and since 2009, barely 1%. Right, so where's the productivity increases that have a causal relationship assumed here to a rising median household income? Well, they seem to be going opposite directions, but they're claiming, you see, a causality. A causal relationship here between these two variables, productivity and household income. Now, let's look at this report. When we talk about income for households, there's a number of elements. Wages will determine your income at the median household level. You see, median families, median households, right? Their income is virtually determined by their wages, plus the number of hours they work, plus whatever income transfers they may receive. Those three forces, three variables, right? Wealthy households, way above the median. It's not wages and salaries. It's not hours worked. They don't get transfers, and it's called corporate subsidies transfers. They make their income from capital forms, right? Capital gains, dividends, interest payments, rental income, etc. So when you look at the median only households, you're conveniently ignoring the fact that the wealthiest 1% are running away with the show. You're not talking about capital incomes here. You're only talking about wages, hours worked, and transfers. But even this argument of median incomes, let's look at the median income here, right? Median income, wages plus hours worked, those two together are sometimes called earnings, wages plus hours worked. And then transfers, income transfers, are in addition to that. What are income transfers? Food stamps, unemployment, disability insurance, welfare payments, etc. Those are, and several others. Those are called transfer payments. Right? Okay, so let's look at earnings, wages and hours worked, because if you look just at wages and hours worked, there are no gains going on. in recent years. There's no gains there. And it's all transfer payments that have increased in the last couple years, since 2013, that account for the median household income gains. It's transfer payments. And very important, the Commerce Department redefined the transfers, the definition of transfers, to give a definitional boost to the amount. So, you know, even the transfers, you know, some of it, you know, increased because more and more people are depending on food stamps than ever before, and more people have gone in and gone on disability in order to survive, especially as unemployment benefits have been taken away. So there is some real increase in transfer incomes that have boosted household incomes, but a lot of it is just definitional. In other words, we're falsifying the true picture of income by redefining it and assuming, when you talk about median household income, that wages and hours worked are rising too. A couple of weeks ago on the show, we talked about wages, right, and pretty much showed that for the bottom 80% households over 100 million, there's been no wage increases. It's all been at the top. Where there have been some increase in earnings is that slowly the hours of work per week have been increasing. So the earnings gains have been because people are working longer and not because wages have been rising. So let's look at earnings, wages, and hours. Well, if you look at wages and hours, in 2015-16, the last 2 years when all this income boost is supposed to have been occurring, for men, earnings have actually gone down, you see, continued to go down, as they have been since 2007 and even since 2000. We have 16 years of consistent, for male workers, consistent earnings decline. Consistent. The Economic Policy Institute has put out some interesting information that clarifies some of this falsification. If you look at here in 2015 and 16, for the lowest 20%, the poorest 20% of households in 2015 and 16, their household income, i.e., not just wages and hours, but transfers too, have continued to decline. It declined another 5.2% in 15, and another 2.7% this past year. Okay. And in fact, it's declined every year since 2007. In some years, double digit. Between 2010 and 14, it was double digit every year. So it's been going backwards, backwards, backwards. For years now, the bottom 20%. Oh, what about the next 20%? Well, in 2015, a 4% decline and a 0.2% increase in 16. So net, last 2 years. And, of course, that too, that bottom second 20%, has declined every year since 2007. All right, so 40%, okay, have declined. Let's look at the third 20% quintile, as they call it, right? Minus 3.1% in 15, minus 0.4% in 16. And it, too, every year, a decline since 2007. How about the fourth? Oh, every year, a decline since 2007, except last year when we've had a paltry 0.4% gain in income. My goodness, what is going on here? All right, so what about the 80th to 95th percentile? Well, every year a decline, except last year a 2.9% increase. Every year, negative, negative, negative. Not as much as the bottom 60%, but, you know, you can add it all up. There's no real evidence for the bottom 95% of income gains. Right? On average, change in average annual household income by income group, 2007 to 2016, Economic Policy Institute data. There's been no gains here, whether you're talking about incomes, and certainly not you're talking about wages and hours worked. It'd be even worse, particularly for the bottom 60%. It would be even worse if there weren't an increase in food stamps and in Medicaid, right, under the ACA, the Medicaid increase, and disability, millions of people going on Social Security disability. You know, if it wasn't for that, these figures would be even worse for household income. Where's the gains here, fellas, right? But, oh, if you read the business press, oh, you know, there's been a big shift here in the last 2 years. Well, what about the top 5%? Well, the last 2 years, the top 5%, you know, have been improving. 3% gain in household income in 15 and 8.7% last year. 8.7%, right? You know, the real gainers in all this is the 1%. And the lion's share of even their gain is the 0.1% average annual household income. Ideology obfuscates the facts, right? Changes, inverts, you know, the relationships between the facts, distorts it by de-emphasizing or ignoring or removing some of the facts and some of the propositions, right? Substitutes the facts, deletes, reverses, converts, inserts. You see, this is how language games are played to create ideological notions that aren't based on reality, in fact, contradict reality, reverse reality, but makes it sound like, whoa, things are really getting better. Well, thank you, David Brooks. You really made a convincing argument here, Mr. Liberal Republican New York Times editorialist. And thank you, Holtz Eakin, well-positioned economic economist prostitute, you know, for the two wings of the corporate party of America. You know, this is how it goes on and on. And we're going to hear a lot more of this, even though, you know, the New York Times here in an editorial says today, the Census Bureau says a change in the survey methodology in 2014 could have increased incomes. Well, I'm glad they admitted that, but of course that wasn't the header. That wasn't the title. It was buried in the article. Right. Yes, the definition, they simply redefined incomes, income transfers, and that's how they get this anemic increase in recovery of incomes in the last 2 years, which is all at the top. If you just look at median household incomes, and if you throw in this redefinition of transfers and don't look at just hours and wages, you know, if you look at hours and wages, everybody's going backwards still, you see. Certainly the bottom 80% households. You know, there's about 130 million households, so 80% of 130 million, you know, what do you get? You get about 105, 110 million households. Still going back now for 10 years, every year, so cumulatively, you know, significant. And then they wonder why people are pissed off. You know? But yet, you know, the Democrats and all of those still talking about identity politics, right? It's a diversion. Identity politics is a diversion from this reality and this ideological machine that is intensifying and will continue to intensify, and we'll talk more about it as time goes on. Next week, we're going to have people talk about Bernie Sanders and the new Medicare for All proposition. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.